I mean, that was one of the great things about camp, that you had the option to do and try stuff.
They had started rumors. Townies are coming into camp. Townies are coming into camp. And people were really anxious at night. Kids were really anxious. Yeah. Staff was really anxious.
I remember cooking London broil and hamburgers and hot dogs on the golf course.
Very funny. So the first year I start, I'm an alanim. I'm an older soph. They tell me I have to wait on tables. I didn't have a clue what that even meant.
Jay and I, we used to be ODs together. At night, we would sit in the Boys Head cabin porch. I remember one night, myself, Jay, and John Cotley were on OD. We'd just sit in the bunk and play cards and laugh and eat ice cream. And I remember the kids coming out of Boys Bunk 5 and asking us to be quiet because we were too noisy. And we were keeping the campers out.
Welcome to episode 11 of the One Nation Road Camptavia podcast. I'm Rob Goodwin. Today is June 30th, 2026. My guest tonight was Indalia, 1983, Birria, 1989. She had three different stints at Tavia, and I believe she's the first guest on this podcast to receive the Kalenu dedication. Welcome, Shira Citron. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Great to finally get together.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So you were lucky to go all the way from Dahlia to Birria, and you were a CIT, and you're from New York, but your family had ties to Massachusetts. How were you introduced to Tavia? Tell us about that.
We actually just talked about that with my family this weekend. So my dad was born in Brookline, Massachusetts, grew up in Brookline, went to Brookline High, and kids from his school went to Tavia, but my grandmother could not afford to send him there. I was born in Brookline, lived in Framingham until I was three. We moved to New York. We kept in touch with a few families, one of which the older kids went to Tavia. So my dad finally could, you know, afford to send my brother and I to camp. And we were at the time two of maybe five kids from New York that were at camp when we started. So it was that one family tie that brought us there. And that family still has their kids there. So like my friends' kids are still there and they're still very much active in the camp community.
That's very neat. That's very neat. And now you had a brother at camp as well, right?
We joke again in my family that like if there's, you know, like 100 points of love for camp, like they're either all going to go in one bucket, that like they both siblings can't love it equally. Cause my brother liked camp. He was there until he was a CIT. He went on the Israel trip, which is probably very similar to your Israel trip, which was much different than the Israel trip now. But my brother never really quite like grasped onto it the way I did. So my brother was there until 1987. And then now he only tolerates when I talk about camp.
Gotcha. Now, I did not go on the Tavia Israel trip.
You went on your own Israel trip.
I went on my own, my confirmation class from Temple Emmanuel in Worcester. So that was my CIT year and why I ended up in the kitchen the year after.
Which was a place of like pride and, you know, like it was super cool to work in the kitchen. You know, the kitchen boys were like the thing.
Yeah, I would have preferred to have been a JC at that point. But that's how that worked out.
I think you made your way back in pretty good. It proves that skipping a CIT summer is not really, if you're the right candidate, it doesn't affect your history at camp.
True, true. You know, I tried to stay involved when I was in the kitchen also. Now, I want you to tell a story. Now, your brother had a special camp birthday.
My God.
I think you need to tell that story.
How did you know about that story?
I know. I do my homework.
It's a pretty good one. My brother, it must have been turning maybe 16, 15 at the time. I can't remember what year it was. I should be able to. It was like, 14, something like that. Anyways, my brother was from my first, I don't know. My dad must have told me we probably did the birthday call earlier in the day. And my dad must have told my parents were divorced, running in very different like lanes in terms of camp. My mom was like, got us there. And my dad just like checked on us. But he arranged for a belly dancer to come to camp to like surprise my brother in the dining hall. But he did not tell administration. He did not check it with anybody. He just did it, which was very much my dad's thing. He works in the entertainment industry, so that's not that surprising. But I had, you know, we're sitting at the dinner, we're waiting. We were going to Roller Kingdom that night. So dinner was early. And I don't know if my dad knew that. So I'm waiting, waiting. And like, she never showed up. So of course I like ran, or I didn't think she was showing up. I ran over my brother's table and was like, Dad sent you Belly Dancer. I guess she didn't come. And then the next thing you know, Belly Dancer came like into the dining hall and essentially performed like a lap dance for my brother during the dining hall. And that night, my brother has a late August birthday, August 12th. We went to Roller Kingdom that night and competition broke that night. So people thought that the Belly Dancer was like a competition fake out. And it was the year that Bill Reinstein like sang a song and they played it over. He recorded a song at Canopy Lake in that like recording booth. It played that night while we were at Roller Kingdom. We went back to the camp and on each of our beds was a cookie with our color war, our competition team, the letter on it. But my brother's birthday. Yeah. I don't know how many other belly dancers have made it in and out of camp successfully.
So you knew, but the administration didn't know?
My dad didn't check it. He didn't check anybody. Was there to check with anybody? He just, this is what he wanted to do. So people sent balloons, not Phil Citron. He sent a belly dancer.
And then like today, there's no gate. So this person just drove straight in. That's
parked by the infirmary, probably walked in. I'm sure somebody at some point like clocked it. Yeah. You know, it was very, very funny.
That's hysterical.
At the time.
So
better if my dad had broke color war. That would have been amazing.
Well, that's true. So is your brother in Yavna or not?
No, Adam started. No. He was in Tel Don, which doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
You would know it. And his first summer, he was in now what is Tel Hai, but to us was the boys' CIT cabin. That was his first bunk. And when I went to camp with my brother went in 1982. When my parents dropped him off, I was like, I want to stay. I vividly remember my parents saying, we packed a trunk for you. I was like, you did? And they were like, no. And my brother went for one session, like 1 month, first year before I did. But I just thought, I'm like, that bunk is so cool. The campus is cool. I was like, I was ready to go before it was even my time.
Sure, sure.
And I would have been the kind of kid, if you could, I don't think back then you really could extend. Once you did 1 month, there weren't a lot of kids who were like allowed to then extend for two. You know, the camp was smaller and they couldn't handle it. And I was like, I did not want to leave. I still didn't want to leave.
Of course not. And so for all your years as a camper, what memories stick out?
I mean, I have the classic ones, you know, like the trip days. You know, I think why I always liked, you know, what I liked about what you put forth for camp on social media and, you know, your kind of sensibilities, that some of my most core memories don't really resonate to kids now and not even to my friends. But I remember like being in Solo Limb and winning like a lip sync contest or something. And we didn't go to Riverside. We went like into like Nashua to like a pizza place, like, you know, and like walk into Riverside. Some of those small nuances that are not like historical benchmarks at camp. You know, I don't have a ton of memories. I mean, I remember it all, but I don't like put competition high up on my list. And I wanted to ask you, do you refer to it as color war or competition?
I think of it as competition, but I know it's color war now.
I'm like, yeah. They, kids can't take it really serious. I'm like, this is not serious. When we did it, it was competition. It mm-hmm. was serious. I was like, you guys, this is like 3 days of fun. It's color war. We did competition. But a lot of my memories, my core ones are not necessarily tied into some of the things that people would think a color war or, you know, like even, you know, things like that. But like certainly just, you know, like the Tevye radio station, sitting OD at night as a counselor, things that don't exist anymore. And, you know, when there wasn't anything in Brookline, New Hampshire, when you and I had the pleasure of being there, you know, there was Riverside there. You could go into Milford. There was like Shaw's and it's like on CIT night out. There was like Shaw's and like one other grocery store. And like, that was it. And now there's so much to do at night. They all have cars. They go off. Like, I just remember lights out and staying in camp and curfew was a little later, just sitting on the tennis courts for like hours laughing. So those kind of like more, you know, like secret things, like, you know, being younger, working on Kalenu and, you know, kind of fun things like that and like staying up late and that sort of stuff. I always joke. And if I went to camp now, it'd still be the same. When you are in the girls' rec hall, you're looking at the stage in the right-hand corner back there, that is like an untouched relic. And in those cabinets are old envelopes of like Jostens, which was the company that did the Kalenu when we would submit the pages and things like that. And I love that every time I go to camp, I look in the girls' rec hall, I'm like, oh, no one's cleaned this yet. And it's like, these things are still there. So those kind of like, you know, little things. I know where there's a secret light switch that not many people at camp know, how to turn off the floodlights on the bug rope bunks. Things like that stick with
me. Yeah. Well, when I was at the Alumni Shabbat a week ago Saturday, you know, got the tour.
It looks great. Salads,
yeah. And going into the girls' rec hall, I said, well, this is cool. You know, Seth Feldman Fitness Center and everything. But then I thought, I still miss, you know, when I think about eating activities in the girls' rec hall and how they were special.
Absolutely.
And even after LBS was built, you know, we still had evening activities in there. You know, I can remember movies. I can remember Songfest still being in there.
Oh my God, yes. You know. You think about it from, it's nice that the camp is growing. Like, I like that it's bigger and that it's a nice problem that they can't fit in Girls Rec anymore. But to your point, like Sleepaway Camp and at least Tevye in particular, I mean, that Girls Rec Hall is a really special place. And like, you know, if those walls could talk, and as they keep like chopping away at it and it gets smaller and smaller, but like it still has a real like kind of magical sense to it of like, you know, people would be painting Final Social and Banquet, you know, posters in there and like locking the door so nobody could see and, you know, all of the kind of like funny business that would happen behind Girls Rec Hall and the like mysterious photography room that you're like,
right.
When you were younger, you didn't know that there was like anything below Girls Rec Hall. It was like, wait, there's rooms down there.
I think maybe I'm wrong, but if the kids today could see like one evening activity in the full Girls Rec Hall, you know, it would be something. You know.
Oh my gosh. It's, I mean, I remember Songfest being in there and like, you know, Tisha B'Av services and things like that. But again, like, I think it's nice that the camp is growing, more kids, more energy. But they, even when we talk about competition, and I was laughing and you were saying you were the first team to come in fourth.
Yep.
But I was like, remember, I mean, I guess I didn't realize that there were four teams before there were all, because when I was there for my first 5 or 6 years, it was just Negev and Galil. That was it. And when Sharon came in, I was like, fancy, like a third team, but I didn't realize that there was ever a time where there was more than two and then went back to two.
Well, I remember there were always three. And then in 1979, there were four. That was the first year. And I think they, if I remember correctly, in 81, there was two. So, you know, I think it went back and forth a number of times.
I didn't even know that. Like, I did not know that prior to like that. I just always thought it was like Negev and Galil the whole way through, like
no.
Easy to pack for. And I was like, oh, there were four teams.
Yep. I remember always Negev, Galil, and Sharon.
Yep. I remember the time when I realized that like it really didn't matter the score. It was really just like whoever burned the rope first. I was like, you guys can try all you want. I was like, but I was truthfully like, you know, never really a big like competition fan. It wasn't my thing. I much preferred, again, like I didn't like that the last week of camp became all about that. I really just liked, I liked when camp ran as it was. So I didn't always like when they switched things up. And even as I got older, like, and new things came to be, I really like the, you know, like the old stuff. And I have the good fortune of a lot of my friends send their kids to sleepaway camp, some to Tevye, some not. But I always say, people ask me like, what's special about Tevye in particular? I always say, you know, it doesn't matter how many years, respectfully, that place is still dirt and popsicle sticks. Like, they have to make some advances. Like, how was the mister? Did you go under the misting machine?
I didn't go under it, but I saw it.
I'm like, yeah, we just were hot. Like, that was it. You just were hot. You didn't have a mister. But I like the fact that they have improved the camp in areas that should be improved, and some of it stays the same. That like some of the evening activities are the same. The activities stay the same, and the essence of the camp, you know, isn't about let's build a huge field house with a digital scoreboard and, you know, have equestrian and like all this customized stuff. I like, and computers and a lot of technology. I like the fact that it's still, you know, really like true to like what it was when we were there. It's one of my favorite things is going back and seeing some of the stuff that has not changed.
Right. And you know, I don't remember Carla War competition taking over any period of time, even when it was 2 weeks. I didn't really, that wasn't my perception at all. And I guess the kids today, if you said it was going to be 2 weeks, they'd check out. Of course, that's, you know, that's two weeks out of 3.5
right.
of the second month, right?
Isn't it amazing? Those few less days makes a big difference.
Yeah.
When you went to camp, did you feel like, I always think, and again, this is, I'm not a parent, so I have a different perspective of it, but like, you know, there wasn't a lot of like checking And when you were like on administration, if you can think back, like, did you have a lot of interaction with the parents of the campers?
No, I mean, I was assistant boys' head counselor for one and a half summers.
There's probably also only like one phone at camp back then, so we didn't like have the opportunity.
Right.
But I remember being like that first summer I was on administration, a lot of calls from parents and a lot of like, you know, logging the calls and a lot of interaction with them, which I was happy to do. And I remember asking my mom, when Adam and I went to camp, like, did you check on us? Did you ever call? Were you worried if you didn't get a letter? She goes, I dropped you off in June, picked you up in August.
Right.
She was like,
right.
That was it. She's like, if they needed me, they called me. And I was like,
one stop for visiting day.
If that, we were the kind of kids. I was like, you don't have to come. It's fine. I was like, what do I need? I didn't want to leave camp. I didn't want to, when they started letting us go out of camp on visiting day, I always preferred to stay. Again, the same family, the Elfbaum family, Annie Factor, who's now there and her son is still a camper. Her daughters have already been done being counselors. Her parents, my parents, we always, oh, and Adina, who's the girls, had her parents too. They would come and we would stay in camp and just like, we didn't want to leave.
Right, right.
Like, I don't need to go to the Pheasant Lane Mall.
Right. And I think when I went, so a couple of parents may have snuck their kids out because you know you couldn't leave. But that did happen. I can't say it happened a lot.
When you went, what was your first day like? Were you part of like in the time when you were a camper? Were they lining up on the road to wait to get into camp the first day?
Yes,
like the running of the bulls for the beds.
Yeah, I don't remember being in line for very long, so I don't know if by the time we showed up, the line had already started moving. I don't remember.
God, that was
all
also
years,
like so legendary. We would stay at the Howard Johnson, like, you know, right in Lake Nashua, which is now a Ferrari dealership. Insane. Like, and line up because like you needed to get your bed. Like we, you know, the bus didn't exist. We took the bus home from camp, the New Yorkers, but it wasn't until I was a Bogue that they started doing a bus to camp. And there it would picked up in Westchester. And we stopped in Danbury.
Danbury, yep.
And then we went to camp. And then there was also the Long Island bus that picked up like the 12 kids who were from Long Island and like the 20 kids who came from like New York and Westchester. And like, that was it. We were always the last ones there. So I always had like the shittiest bed. Even when I was a CIT, I took the bus and I was a CIT. I had a bunk bed right by the bathroom in the girls' CIT cabin. Like, didn't matter. Still the last one there.
So when you were a camper, did you say, I want to do boating and canoeing?
No. When I was a camper, I wanted to be on water skiing.
Okay.
Who didn't? And my JC summer, I think I was too young to be on water skiing, or like they had filled up something else with it. I think maybe you needed a WSI for some reason. I wasn't. So I always knew I wanted to be on the waterfront for sure. But you didn't have to have your WSI. If I went now, I would never pass a lifeguard test. I'd be on arts and crafts or like drama probably.
Sure,
but I knew that like the action was at the waterfront. My brother and I were always visiting day. We had a water ski show. My brother and I were like a brother sister duo in like the water skiing show.
I was in that.
I mean, just like, again, like things we wouldn't do now. Insurance. Adam was on trick skis, which again is something they don't do anymore probably now. And I did a trick where like I started on Bill Grant's like back, like piggyback, and climbed up onto his shoulders. Like, just like, again, like it's just sort of like funny. And that was like, and we did visiting day was also like if you were in drama, you did like a snippet from the show you were in.
Right.
Oh my God. Good times.
Yeah.
Good times.
So you took a year off after CIT.
I was CIT and I was a junior counselor. I was a JC my first year. I did not go back to camp the summer between my senior year in high school and my freshman year in college. So my first year as a full counselor, because being from New York, I was on a different academic schedule than the kids from Massachusetts. So my high school graduation was the day that the day orientation started. And I went to University of Miami. My first day of college was maybe 3 days after camp ended. And since I lived in New York, I couldn't go home on the days off to shop for college and prepare for college. So I literally had to stay home. P.S. I went to Miami, and my first day of school freshman year was a Category 5 hurricane. And then I was sent home for 3 months. So I was like, I could have totally gone to camp. but I physically was not able to have gone to camp and prepare for college. They didn't have, like they do now, where some of the kids leave early. It wasn't an option. And then I went back for two more. I took a summer off when I came back. So it would have been my second year being a counselor when they were doing the staff at the bunk assignments. The girls had counselors reading off the bunk assignments. And my friend Corey Brand at the Now Penn, she also had taken that year off. And we both came back and they're reading off the bunk assignments and they get to like older sofs. Like they get to Alunim and like they haven't called our names. I looked at her and I was like, I think they forgot to give us bunks because we had only been junior counselors. And then they got to us and I don't know how, but I got Birria. I was like, snap. I was like, Birria counselor? My second year being a counselor. And it was fantastic. And then my third year being a counselor, I was like, I will take SOFs again. I do not need to like be in bogues. But I remember vividly like thinking, I was like, I think they forgot to give us bunks. Like, there's no way we got bogues. We're idiots and we're babies. Like I was 18. I was like, no way. So that summer, yeah, I was 18 years old. A Birria counselor getting, and then I was on water skiing. So for it went 2 years on water skiing, getting paid $2,500 to drive a boat around a lake.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this is the life. Like,
right.
I'm never
right.
leaving. Unfortunately, real life caught up. And when I had the opportunity to go back a second time, it was just as great. It was fantastic. Yeah, no, like lightning striking twice.
Sure. And just, we'll get to that in a minute.
So
I don't know if you heard Joey Karras say when he was on water skiing, you know, first period, they would just pile 11 kids in the boat and drive out. Can you imagine that today?
I mean, we're so lucky that there wasn't anything worse, but we were severely underqualified for what we were doing. Like really, really. I mean, I read a book. I took like a test with like the New Hampshire state, like boating license. And I mean, I was, anybody else you'd ask, I was not the kind of person who wouldn't have taken that seriously. So I certainly did my, you know, job well. And I was, in my second year, I was head of water skiing. And I just, growing up, never thought I'd reach that pinnacle. I was like, no, people like Bruce Carton are head of water skiing. Mm-hmm. Like, not me. And I was like, I get to write my name inside, like, the sailing shed on the wall. Like, mm-hmm. I really didn't think that life got any better than that.
Sure, sure. Well, I know, like, in Connecticut, I think you could take the safe boating certificate as long as you're, I think, I don't know if it's 14 or 12. I mean, that's not commercial, you know, that's just private, which is,
I mean, again, back then, Patanapo was not nearly as populated. So there were not as many boats out in the lake. And I can understand, again, like, you know, knowing what I know now about how the camp runs and the environment of Brookline, New Hampshire, and like the different things about the property. And I was always incredibly fascinated with like the Cohen Foundation, now the Cohen Camps, and the fact that, you know, Eli and Bessie had invested in Arnold and Annabelle and like so much property around camp and no matter what, like would never sell it. And that like half of the lake. So I think back then, you know, if that whole lake was populated, you know, 360 and we were just the slice we had, how much different the waterfront would be. But it wasn't quite as risky because there was only like, you know, three other boats out. There was nobody living in Brookline, New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Let alone on Lake Patanapo.
One memory I have, I was a bogue, and oftentimes I had one or two counselors that were water ski instructors. And I think it was, I'm going to make it up because I think I remember this. It was bunk night, and they decided they would take us water skiing after dinner. It was really nice. And I can remember the lake was like glass. And of course, no one had a camera. No one took any pictures. But it was really special to be on the lake after dinner, you know, sun's going down. It was
About that all the time with, you know, digital and like pictures. And I think to myself, I just said this the other day to my friend Doug, a longtime camp friend, and I was with him and I said, you know, think about it. I went to camp, I had, if I was lucky, 48 exposures. My mom maybe sent me with two rolls of film. You had 24 to 48 opportunities to take a picture. I mean, I have all my photo albums there. I mean, they've been slightly deconstructed because scanning pictures and taking them out, but I've kept everything. I have every relic from camp, every like, you know, CIT carnival, like a pipe cleaner ring and all of those things and the messages from the bunks. But I laugh at the fact of like, I have 30,000 pictures today. I took 100 pictures alone on my camera. And I'm like, I went for 8 weeks. I had 24 chances to make like a lasting memory. And then like hope that your mom would like develop them and like put them in an album. You wouldn't lose them. It's hysterical.
Film was 12 when I was a kid. And I know I had multiple rolls of film when I went to camp.
My mom was not sending me with multiple. It was like, here's, you got two rolls. Make them last.
Yeah.
It was expensive.
Yeah.
I remember being in photography and developing like some pictures. I still have some of them, but they're like impossible to see. My photographic skills were not.
Gotcha.
And then my time in the dark room was not great.
And we had flash bulbs so you could take them at night and they never came out very well. Well, a couple did. But you were limited to how many pictures you could take. But
it ties back to what you asked about my favorite memories. I just think then, like, I was so much more in tune to like experiencing camp and remembering things versus looking at, and the pictures that I have are like so select. And now that I've looked at them so many times, like they are, you know, I can remember like the circumstances around said pictures. And, you know, I have a lot of camp pictures like post camp. You know, I have, my photo albums are broken down by like groups of friends. So I have ones that are like friends' weddings, you know, post camp camp. That's what I call it, post camp camp. Like when we would hang out, it still felt like camp, but it was post camp camp.
Sure, sure. And like the just going back to 1 second, as far as competition, color war, and I had a lot of friends and I had campers that weren't into competition per se or athletic, and just seeing them excel in different things was great. You know, it wasn't like, okay, you know, if you're into athletics, you have these friends, and if you're not, you have those friends. That's not how it was. And that's not how it was when I was a counselor either, you know, which I really liked.
I agree. Did you have a nickname growing up, like, or at camp when you were younger, older?
Yes.
What was it?
You know what it was.
Come on, tell us.
They call me Goody.
I mean, I don't know if you're like underselling your role in camp and the, I will call it the Apache. I mean, it's iconic.
I don't think I look at it that way.
For those listeners who are not aware, this man is a task in the Apache Relay. And I don't know if they still do it. I don't even know what it's called now. It's not called the Apache.
They call it the Race to the Fire. There's a Hebrew name for it. The Hayesh Relay, I think.
That's it. But like, we the race is almost over. The race is almost over. The race is almost over. I sure wish Goody Goodman was still here. I mean, my friends and I recite that not in a context of competition. When the Beery 89 girls first started getting engaged, one of the engagements was announced. Two girls got engaged first, Stacy and Carrie. And they're going to listen to this and they will fact check me. Stacy got engaged first, but I think Carrie wound up getting married first. And in the email chain that announced it, we weren't texting at them. It was like, something to the effect of like, you know, just because you get to the fire first doesn't mean you win competition. And the jokes went back and forth off of that of like, you know, the race is almost over. The race is almost over. The race is almost over. I sure wish you get a good one. We're still here. I mean, it's amazing.
That's funny.
It's so iconic.
Very funny.
I'm like, guys, I'm going to talk to Goody Goodwin tonight. It's like, he's an Apache task.
And they hung the phone up on you when you said that.
No, sure. My friends, you know, are just as into talking about camp and reliving, you know, a place that was so special to us. And, you know, we really love other people who want to kind of keep those parts of the memories alive. And again, I think what makes Tevye different than a lot of other camps is we oddly have a small kind of alumni portal. You know, people really are able to connect individually. We didn't need like a big machine kind of behind it. Like a lot of camps have the camp initiating and maintaining alumni relationships. And I think Tevye's alumni maintains it outside of the support of the Cohen camps. Not that they don't provide support for us, but I remember saying when we first started talking about engagement and alumni relations and keeping the kind of like history alive. And I'm like, we do it ourselves. We don't need we don't need our own Instagram, handle or our own like Facebook group. And like everybody kind of talks and has their own things and, you know, sees each other kind of really naturally, that where some other people needed to, like, you know, have a lot of oomph behind it. But, you know, my friends are very, very much into it.
Sure, sure. And then now you came back, what, 10 years later in 2004?
Yeah, it was a total fluke. A couple of friends were still in. Benji Marchette was a boys' head counselor, and we had stayed in touch, and Matt Brand was still very much in the camp world. And I had interviewed with Adina a year before to come, and I was still working. It wasn't happening, but yeah, everything lined up. I had took a break from work. I'm an event planner. And at the time I was still doing events and weddings. And I'd been working since the day I graduated college. And so when I was 27, I went back to camp. Wow. I made my dad drive me to camp, and I lived in Friendship, which was a building I had never stepped foot in. I had been in the Cohen house because my brother did Hebrew tutoring with Avishag. So I had been in Cohen. I had never been inside Friendship, and they assigned me a room in Friendship. And I was like, my God, I'm staying in Friendship. It was insane, like, sure, so crazy, sure, to me. And yeah, so by 2004, I was the assistant girls head, and I did all the evening activities. And then 2005 and 2006, I was the girls head counselor. 2005, I was a girls head counselor with another woman. And that was the first year they had two. The boys area had one, girls mm-hmm. area had two head counselors. Okay. And the girls head counselor porch was not yet renovated, so it was only for one person. So I lived where bunk 26 is now, between Old Berry Bet and the health center, or the infirmary, behind the director's cabin. I lived in a trailer. They got an RV for me, and I lived in a camper in the Bogorot area.
Nice.
It was, yeah, cool. It was very cool. It was like, I remember saying to the counselors, like, you guys, we have to make this fun. I'm going to be living in this RV, like, in the Bogorot area. And we, like, I had camping chairs outside. It was very fun. And then in 2006, they had built the new Girls Head cabin. So I had the inaugural year of staying in the Girls Head cabin. And this was, again, like, you know, really pre-cell phones. I maybe had a cell phone, I think, at camp, but it was pre-social media. I remember 2006, that during breakdown of camp, was the first time I'd ever heard Facebook. So my second coming at camp was also blissfully just before the social media bubble. So, like, mm-hmm. a lot of people don't know that I had those 3 years. We weren't posting about it. We weren't, you know, having those things. It was still really kind of pure. And Benji Marchette was there for 1 year with me, and Matt Brand. So I also had a lot of very good friends who still were on administration with me. And it was almost better than the first time. It was great. And I have all new batch of friends. Granted, they are all 15 years younger than me, but when people ask me, like, oh, I'm going out with a friend from camp, and they ask, like, you know, phase one or phase two? Like,
gotcha.
Who is it?
Now, for those who don't know, there are large differences in the head counselor's cabin, or the one that was built when you went back. So fill our viewers and listeners in on what the difference is. It's not one room type cabin.
In 2004, so it was end of 2005, when they had talked to us about that they were going to be redoing the head counselor porches, they asked Ed Plepman was the director, and he sat down, and he and Pearl Laurie was still involved in the camps, and they sat us down. They asked me and Maddie what we would want in the porches, like, if they're going to redo it, like, being that we had lived in them in a couple of different iterations, and that we both also lived in Friendship and all the different places. So what would we want? And we made up this crazy list of, like, things. We were like, a hot tub, you know, like, we had all these things. And Ed was like, no, seriously. But, and then we also did a very hardcore pitch for the head counselor cabins to be called the House of Sherat and the House of Matira, because we wanted them to be named after us. This is before Beit Shirab was a thing, before I had a building that wasn't even my own. But they have three bedrooms that are, some are interconnected, and they all have outside, two have outside door access and private showers. And there's an office space for where you could actually have, like, a private conversation with the camper, and just, you know, better space for the counselors. And before that, it was a box with, like, a cardboard wall between mm-hmm. the head counselor's bedroom and where the counselors sat OD and smoked cigarettes. Like, that was it. And they were really lovely. And I think that any, and you saw it yourself, and for anybody who hasn't had a chance to go to camp, for an alumni Shabbat who's listening, I really encourage you to get up there and see where the donations have gone and the capital improvements the camp has made, because I think all the things they have done still feel true to camp, but they are more all seasonal. They are, you know, handicapable, accessible. So ramps and, you know, certainly more inclusive of people who need to come to camp who have special needs, and even being able to provide a safer space to hold meds, to, you know, have first aid things, to be able to communicate better amongst the camp and have more organizational infrastructure in terms of like paperwork and communicating with the staff, and which is something they need to learn for their workforce, that it's not just a place to hang out. So I think they did a really good job of all the new things that are being built, also kind of give kids a little more real world, like practicality. It's not just like a box with a cardboard wall.
Right, right. And one funny thing that occurred to me was the telephones around camp at the head counselor's cabins, the director's cabin. There was one in the office.
Single. Do you know what it was called?
Single digit dialing.
Well, I remember when we got the phones, you might have left by then. It was the phone system camp was called the Executone phone. And it was a very big deal. And that's all everyone was talking about, the Executone phones, the Executone. And you could, you know, call from porch to porch and you could make announcements from the phones. And again, like, I don't remember what it was like before we had the Executone phones and like
the Aruga button being in the girls' rec hall.
Right,
the Aruga button was there.
And Did anybody have a clock, a watch? How do we tell the time? Somebody must have had a clock.
Somebody had one.
Well, somebody was like, it's time.
But the phone system as it was single digit dialing. Five was the boys' area. I don't remember what the other ones were.
We had a sheet. I remember it was like a sheet of like the different numbers. There was a boys' area, girls' area, waterfront, health, infirmary, office, kitchen, dining hall. Like where else would we call arts and crafts? Because Larry Chaykin would answer the phone. Craft shop. Like another icon, legend.
Yeah. And you know, you were talking about friendship. I think I was in friendship once.
Were you in trouble?
No. If I remember correctly, this, I believe, was when I was in the kitchen and I looked up to Larry Chaykin as a, you know, as a camper. I mean, you know, see, you know, the epitome of patience and loving what he does. And so I popped in on him. I think it was when I was in the kitchen. I popped in on him and there he was in the kitchen and we had a chat, and it could have been 20 minutes. It could have been an hour. It could have been once, it could have been five times. Doesn't matter. It was a special time to just sit with Larry and say, hey, I remember this when you were program director. I remember when you were this. And you know, what he didn't tell me was, I guess in 73, when the director left in the middle of the summer, and I know there were circumstances, but I guess the staff begged him to be the acting director, and he didn't do it.
That would have been amazing. They just don't make people like Larry and Roberta.
No,
like
they
just, it just doesn't exist anymore. Their
right.
commitment to the camp, their literally the crafts that they made were, excuse me, like so beautiful. And they were so sweet. I remember they were from Long Island. So we had this kind of like New York sort of bond of it. And I last time I was at camp, which was 2 years ago, it was still there. When you walk up the stairs, they have all the old collages and there's pictures of me as like, you know, a little kid still in them. My parents still have a few, like I have a yarn. My dad has a yarn cat. My mom still has like a clock. Those kind of like, I remember when Larry used to, when we got this machine, he would make everybody like name tags. It was like a plastic thing. And he would like make name tags for it. I also used to love to go up to the Girls Rec Hall because you could sneak out of the window and like sit on top of Girls Rec Hall. That's a kind of secret like hiding place. So good. Yeah. But that Aruga hidden behind like a wood panel.
Yeah. And I think, I swear I still have this somewhere that I think in Arts and Crafts, they made name tags for visiting day. I wish I could find that.
Like you wore yours or it was for like your parents?
No, staff. The staff would wear a name tag and I think it would have your department on it or something like that.
You know, there's so many like funny things. I in general, like in life, I have this kind of like weird, unnecessary fear that I'm going to use a slang or a nickname for somebody and they won't remember the joke. But like I always say, like, since I don't have kids, I still have a lot of space in my brain for like my own memories. I haven't had to clear things out, but I saw that you know, in terms of like visiting day, a little slang and the name tags, and they're all wearing them. I was talking to someone the other day and I was said, Suzanne Silverstein, who's now Suzanne Stein, and her brother was Mike, and her kids are at camp, and her orientation or her like first day name tag said Suzanne. She was also head of athletics, but it had two A's. She was head of athletics, and like, we still like joke about it. And I text her, you know, recently, I'm like, have you done any athletics lately? Like the name tag, like it was printed. And like, if there was a typo or a spelling error, like you weren't getting another one. That was it. Right. If your name was spelt wrong, that's what your name was going to be. And I was thinking again in terms of, I'm like, I hope everybody always remembers that joke, that no one's going to forget that we made fun that Suzanne was head of athletics. And a friend's son this year is a Yavna counselor, and a friend's son is in Yavna. So like two friends, and it's really like, and part of like my, what would have been my core crew after camp. And it's really kind of insane that one person's kid is another kid's counselor. And I made a comment on Facebook to the parent. I said, well, you better not bagel him. And I was like, oh, I know that they can't tip counselors anymore, but I was like, I hope he remembers what bagel means. And I use it frequently. I work in the service industry, so gratuities are something that is discussed. And someone, I'm like, be careful, you're going to get bageled. Like, nobody knows what that means. And I'm like, I have to explain that. I'm like, oh, it's, yeah. And do you know this might have been also a little past time, that there's, I also frequently refer to orientation, and people don't know what I'm talking about, which in my friend's orientation is peeing in the lake.
Okay. I've never heard of that.
So like they have a whole new batch. We have two kids who are on staff for the first time. I was texting them and I'm like, have fun at orientation. I was like, make sure you do orientation. They're like, what? Did you say the word? Like, is your voice to text not working? I'm like, let me explain. Orientation is when you pee in the lake. Right. Like, okay, we did not know that. Tell your friends, pass it on.
Now, I heard through my research that I think maybe we traded emails, that you were in charge of the fundraiser for the bricks in front of the pavilion.
Yes. And I was myself happy, and Ellen Addis.
Okay, and I was happy to say I found mine.
We're doing another outreach of it. So this, we have a bunch already. We have about 50 that have already been like, you know, paid for and donated, and we're going to do another push. So before next summer, we will do another installation, either keep extending that path or finding another location to do it. But it was incredibly successful and really fun. And I kind of always envisioned it to be like my temple, like when somebody has a baby, they buy a brick, that kind of, you know, thing. But it was really fun. And, it's fun to watch people try to find theirs and remember those things. And my camp friends and I, out of my Beer 89 group, there is one of my friends who's incredibly competitive. And we had a lot of, two were captains of different teams, and, you know, all the shtick that goes along with it. So a friend and I got a brick for one of the girls for like, she's a Sharon girl. She was captain of Sharon. So we got her a brick, but it says, go Galel. And like, we didn't tell her about it. And so we were at the reunion and we're looking at the bricks. And I was like, oh my God, Jillian, did you get this brick over here? I was like, that's so nice that you are supporting Stacy's team. And she was like, they are my most competitive friend, hands down. And then we immortalized at camp her support of the wrong team.
Very nice. She'll never forget that. She won't forget that.
Feels camp prank appropriate.
Right. So, buy a brick.
Exactly.
Dedicate to someone your in memory and honor of, or a group, or an inside joke.
You know, it's a small amount to really have an indelible kind of, you're no longer able to write your names on the walls at camp, rightfully so. And graffiti is severely frowned upon, and as is stealing mementos from camp. I speak from experience. Don't try to take anything. But I think that the bricks are a really, really nice way to kind of admittedly have your name there, and to, you know, that pavilion is a beautiful place, and, you know, where everybody celebrates Shabbat and kind of goes in together. And it was really lovely. It turned out way better than we could have ever thought. And it was absolutely, we were thrilled to have, you know, kind of initiated it, and that the camp was super supportive in getting it done.
Right. And the one thing I didn't do when I was there a week ago Saturday was find your bench.
My bench. I love it.
I'll have to do that next year.
The bench was a gift from my family for planning every wedding and every celebration in my family, pro bono, even though it's my occupation. And when it came, I was totally surprised. I had no idea. And I joked to my family that I was impressed that they did it in my honor and didn't just cut to the memory so they didn't have to replace the plaque when I got older. And I told Ben Porton, I was the director at the time, and I said, Ben, this bench is not for kids who are, or counselors who are getting kicked out. Only people who can sit on this bench is people who are like waiting for a pickup from their parent or like happy kids. So if they get kicked out and they're waiting for a pickup, they're not allowed to sit on this bench. It's only for good people. And I get a lot of pictures from my friends when they go up, and I get like, you know, random spots of people sending me pictures of themselves on the bench. It's
nice.
Incredible. I love nice. It.
So you have to tell me about the, there's a lingo that you'd mentioned about the contraction int.
I love int. That's one that has not picked up, you know, and I wish I cannot take credit for it. You would have to maybe ask like DJ Atkins. I feel like it was his sort of generation maybe that came up with int.
No.
And it was I know the origin?
Yes. Yes.
Tell me.
Well, okay. So for those who don't know.
Int just negates. It negates things. So like, you know, I'm hot int means I'm cold. It is the N apostrophe T. It mm-hmm. is the equivalent of like, don't do it. And it was a tremendous, summer. It was a huge part of our lexicon. Also the summer of seriously and really being used before and after mm-hmm. every sentence. We had a summer in the 90s that was a lot of like new vocabulary, but int was, it was as if it should have been in the dictionary. We mm-hmm. really, as far as my generation goes, it's a legitimate, you know, part of the English language.
Right, right. The origin is, it goes back to the late 70s and Mark Silk.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did he just come up with it?
Yep.
Genius.
Mm-hmm.
Sad it didn't stick. Yeah. Like, I mean, it stuck for enough time, but to this point, I kept trying to like re-get my friends' kids into it, but they have their own like slang. They don't need mine, but I'm like, try it. It'll catch on. You'll be like, you'll be cool. And they're like, actually, sure, we won't. Please stop trying to make it happen again. But amongst my friends, it's still a big deal. We use it all the time.
Sure.
I mean, the camp lingo, being able to kind of, you know, have a group of friends that you can say something that only a small select people understand is, I think, part of the reason why overnight camp and these kind of like happy cults, you know, exist, that it really does kind of bond you in ways that like finances can't, geography can't, and those kinds of things. And, you know, the songs, there was a period of time years ago where a bunch of us on social media, it was Facebook at the time, got into a kind of competition of saying camp phrases and camp songs and camp lingo, but only using emojis. And then trying to guess what it was. And it was, you know, it was funny because the origin, like there was a very big camp, you know, the song like fish, duck, goose. This is like kind of call and repeat song that then one summer when there was a problem with the lake, it became dead fish. Like it was a whole thing, but we had the shtick back and forth on Facebook of people trying to sing that song and use those phrases like with only emojis. And like, I look at the kids now and they have their own other kind of like lingo and language. They don't have sayings in the Kalinu anymore. So they don't have those kind of like word acronyms and things like that. And I'm like,
don't. Is that right?
No. The kind of like, you know, again, the vocabulary of camp in the 80s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and even when I was there in the 2000s, or just the vocabulary of camp, it being something that only a select few, you know, a language that nobody else can understand. I just taught someone the other day a Hebrew word of the day about house. They were like, do you speak Hebrew? I'm like, no, but I know how to say house. They're like, really? I was like, yes, I like this house. I'm going to Bayit house. They're like, what? I'm like, oh, it's the Hebrew word of the day, camp. It was like a whole rhyme. And now they also know how to say house in Hebrew.
Now, I remember there was one Kalenu, you know, one of those lingo things was a list, and the title of the list was And I Might. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
You know, I don't think we got And I Might
Wear Blue and White, you know, And I Might Wear My Beanie, and I Might Like Competition, you know, that kind of thing.
I love that kind of like the section of the Kalenu that was just humor, you know, like the fact that we had a section for, and even like, again, we didn't have social media, even like at final banquet with like, you know, we did a lot of roasting at camp, mm-hmm. you know, like, I mean, when I was a camper, like Scott Levine would literally get up at final banquet and just absolutely like annihilate people. Like, and we had staff meetings every Friday after lunch. The CITs would go, or Biri and Tachai would go sit in the younger kids' cabins, and all the counselors would have staff meeting. And we would have, like, at the end of the meeting, the directors would walk out and there would be a counselor would get up and just like read through that week's gossip. It was like, I mean, you could not get away with that now. And no, it was
definitely not.
It was not suitable for work or camp. But like, that's what I would say, like, I'm really glad that I got to experience sleepaway camp, you know, in that kind of pure
right
form where, again, my memories were what I chose to remember, not what somebody was videotaping.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But I saw the videos that you posted. Do you have those videos? I mean, I've had the great fortune of seeing a lot of old camp footage. Have you really been able to see a lot of like old things that were videotaped?
Not a lot. Well, I know there's some color war videos. Now, the video you're asking about, is it the
softball game that you posted? That's a great one.
That was one VHS tape, and I found it on a shelf. And yeah.
I had, when I worked at camp, and it must have been 2004 or 5, 6, whatever that was, I found a camp. They were there, like a box of tapes and old slides. And I took them back to New York with me because I knew I was coming back and I just did not want to leave them at camp. They were not important to anybody else but me. At that point, alumni was not working at camp. It really wasn't a thing. Myself, Maddie, Benji. We were some of the first few alumni that worked there, and we didn't have children. We were young, in our late 20s, early 30s. And now I understand why administration takes the shape and form that it does. It's a necessity of being able to, you know, administer a different level of care and attention to the kids. But then we were, you know, we were lucky again. We got in right before insurance became like a thing. But I had the tapes, and I watched like, I had my Beer King was videotaped, all the staff shows, all the plays, like all these things. And I remember bringing them back to camp and talking to Dan Wolf about them. And I know they exist like somewhere, but they're, I mean, even I could remember them minute by minute watching old slideshows and hearing the songs and just like, you know, so fantastic. But I love watching those old things and just thinking about like, again, how simple life was.
Exactly.
We all just wanted to watch the Bogram basketball mm-hmm. and Bogram softball. That was all we wanted to do.
And if the kids didn't want to, they could be anywhere they want to be.
I mean, there's no such thing now. You're not roaming anywhere now.
No, not at all.
They don't know.
So, well, it's been great catching up, Shiera.
I know. I could keep going forever. More. I'm probably like the worst candidate for this because my bandwidth for talking about camp. And I have to thank you for really keeping like, you know, I understand why it's called One Mason Row, but even that to me is sort of like, when we wrote letters to camp, you just addressed it to Camp Tevia, Brookline, New Hampshire, and made it there.
Sure,
We had a P.O. box for a few years. We had box 1,000. But then when they were like, no, there's a street address now. Mm-hmm. I'm like, really? There's a street address? You can't just write Camp Tevia. But I really want to thank you for, you know, your time and effort and energy to keep this part of camp alive. It means a lot to people like me.
Fun.
And I can speak for my friends.
It's fun talking. It's fun getting together with, you know, different generations and you know, I've got a couple of requests out to some folks that I'm hoping will join me like you did tonight, which would be great.
It was great. Thank you so, so, so much for having me.
Thank you, Shiera. So this concludes episode 11 of the One Mason Road Camp Tevia podcast. If you'd like to be a guest or have ideas for future episodes, you can reach me via Facebook Messenger, text me or email me at info@onemasonroad.com. Please subscribe to the One Mason Road Camp Tevia podcast wherever you get your podcast. You can also listen at www.onemasonroad.com. And don't forget to join the One Mason Road Camp Tevia group on Facebook. Thanks again to Shiera Citron for spending time with me tonight. Thanks for listening, everyone. Keep in touch.